Welcome to a very interesting edition of Shedding Lights. I'm your host, Bird, and I'm sitting here with the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Cannabis and Clinical Practice. The journal is called O'Shaughnessy's. Fred Gardner is my guest today. Fred.
Hi, Bird. Glad to be here.
Welcome back to KZSU, because you were here last year for 2 hours. We went over basically kind of your life story, not just the O'Shaughnessy's, but you reported on the 68 riots. Well, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, which the police said turned into a riot because the police caused a riot. But you were reporting. Who were you reporting for back then?
Well, it was called the Ramparts Wall Poster.
Yeah, I've told people that. Yeah, Warren Hinkle?
Warren Hinkle was the genius who conceived it. What happened was Tom Hayden had asked me to. I was working for Ramparts at the time, and Hayden asked if I would come and put out a daily mimeographed flyer to let people know where the action was going to be from day to that each day. And I went into Hinkle's office to ask for a leave to do that, and he just brilliantly conceived this product. He said, we'll call it the Ramparts Wall Poster, and one side will be news from the streets and the other side will be news from the convention.
So you're saying this is where Ramparts was born?
No. Ramparts existed as a magazine.
Oh, okay.
But Hinkle took Hayden had in mind a little mimeographed flyer, and Hinkle, who's really a kind of a publishing genius, envisioned it like in one. Possibly he'd been thinking about it, but I don't think so. He said, "Well, we'll do the streets on one side, and we'll do the delegates on the other." Because in the New Left in those days had real ties. There was a left wing of the Democratic Party, a peace wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, sure.
And Ramparts reporters and editors had good connections with some of the delegates, so we could get Democratic Party delegates wrote for one side of the paper, and movement activists wrote for the other, and I put it all together.
Fred Gardner, our guest today, and now, Fred, you're the, like I said, the editor-in-chief of O'Shaughnessy's. I'm holding the 2010 summer edition in my hand, 64 pages. This is no thin little cheat sheet, little copy.
64 pages of an 11 by 17 tabloid.
Yes, it's very extensive. I went through it all morning, and you, Fred, you blow me away. We met at the farmer's market about 4 years ago over
That's
in
right.
Alameda. You're a customer, and I'm a vendor over there. Mm-hmm. I was a vendor over there, and mm-hmm. I didn't know too much about you. We only got to speak briefly each once a week, and you gave me a copy of the paper last year, and I perused through it briefly, but this issue that I read this morning is just blowing me away. You've got the entire spectrum of medical marijuana and everything that it entails, meaning mm-hmm. it's not about THC, it's not about the politics of it. It's really down to it's very clinical stuff you've gotten into here.
There is a political side of the story, as you know, obviously, and there's a legal side and a medical side and a scientific side and an economic side, and the history of it is fascinating. Cannabis is very pervasive in our culture and in our society, so it's not 6 degrees of separation. It's like 1 degree of separation to almost any topic you can think of.
Yeah, I'll amen that for sure. And what amazed me about this is you covered all that in this issue, and you've got different folks that have come in and written stories for the issue
mm-hmm.
Who know what they're talking about.
That's right. We have a staff, Bird. We have a kind of a collective of writers and activists has grown up around the paper over the years, and I'm very proud to be working with some of these people.
Mm-hmm. That part I didn't realize. And just some of the topics you're covering in this issue is something I'd never heard of, cannabidiol.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another...
Soon to be a household word like serotonin became in the 90s when Lilly was trying to push Prozac.
Aha. Also in this issue, a wonderful article on Louis Armstrong getting arrested in
Los
Angeles.
By Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, in his own words, actually. Another article that just blew me away.
We should call him Louis. He preferred to be called Louis.
Okay.
I read.
You got to hang with an old friend of yours in 2009 before he passed away, Howard Zinn. There's a picture of you and Howard Zinn in Berkeley, and it turns out Howard Zinn did his PhD dissertation on Fiora LaGuardia from New York, who was a anti-prohibition, marijuana prohibition activist, meaning that
I wouldn't say an activist, but he was hip to the fact that it was not as dangerous as the prohibitionists were saying. Should I tell the story of
please LaGuardia? Well, please do. Yeah, let's start right there.
Well, first, Zinn greatly admired LaGuardia. He grew up in Brooklyn when LaGuardia was mayor, and LaGuardia was very beloved, and they wound up having quite a bit in common, because LaGuardia had been in the Army Air Force during World War I and had flown bombing missions over Italy, and then had come to regret the carnage and the destruction. And Howard flew missions over France, occupied France in World War II, and came to deeply regret it. And of course, they both had in common that they tried to give voice to the voiceless. And So Zinn's dissertation and then his first published book was called LaGuardia in Congress.
You explain in the article how this established Howard Zinn as a historian.
Well, it was his first published, yes, I guess you could say that, but he would have established himself in one subject or another. But let me say a little bit more about LaGuardia, because this history's been erased and denied us. LaGuardia, having been in the military, was away, and then he was a congressman from New York City, from Harlem, which was then partly Italian and partly black, partly Jewish. And LaGuardia knew that there'd been a study, the Army had done a study in Panama in the 1920s to determine whether marijuana was dangerous, because the troops stationed in the Canal Zone were known to be using it. And the Army had concluded that it wasn't. And LaGuardia knew that. And it's unfortunate that LaGuardia was out of Congress by 37, was serving as mayor of New York City, because there was virtually no resistance when the prohibition was put through, and the leader of the prohibitionist faction was a congressman from Kentucky named Fred Vinson, and he was mouthing the reefer madness line, and nobody was there to challenge it. And I'm sure that if LaGuardia had been in Congress, he would have challenged it. And the reason I can say I'm sure is because when it went through, and after it went through in 37, LaGuardia went to the New York Medical Society and asked them to do a study to confirm whether the facts that Congress had accepted were true. And the doctors in New York, and so it was a big team with sociologists and various professionals, and they did a 2-year study, and they trained police officers to go undercover and find out the distribution networks in New York, and they also came to the conclusion that this did not present a danger to the people of New York. And if anybody out there can get a hold of O'Shaughnessy's, you can read the magnificent our excerpts from this report, what's come to be known as the LaGuardia Report, about marijuana use in New York City all those years ago.
And you have a website for the paper.
The paper does have a website. It's www.pc, as in pro cannabis, MD, as in medical doctor, 4U, letter U. So it's pcmd4u.org. And the current issue, all the back issues are up on the site. And now the current issue will go up in the next period.
The name of the paper is O'Shaughnessy's. We're here today with the editor-in-chief, Fred Gardner. And Fred, the cover article in this summer edition of O'Shaughnessy's is by you, and the title is Doctors to Study Effectiveness of CBD. And what is CBD? That is cannabidiol.
You got it right.
You helped me pronounce that, and I took some notes on this because it really tripped me out, because I'm a child of the 60s, so we started experimenting with marijuana as back in 60 whatever, and it's still around. But we never heard about cannabidiol. Now, we always heard about THC.
Right.
And in your cover article, you explain in here, scientifically broken down, that the cannabidiol is likely going to be more effective in helping on the medical side with helping people.
I wouldn't say more effective. THC has great medical effects, but the thing about cannabidiol, which has similar medical effects, is that it's non-psychoactive, and in fact it sort of competes with THC and negates the effects of THC. So we may be able to develop strains that have like the anti-inflammatory effects and the neuroprotective effects of cannabis without the psychoactive effects that many people don't like. And it's not because they're prejudiced. I have many friends who will say, I tried pot. I didn't like it. It gave me the jitters, made me a little paranoid, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in our focus groups and preliminary data collection, we've encountered a half dozen of people in this category who like CBD-rich cannabis.
Now, where did cannabidiol come from?
Well, it came from the same plant as THC, and there's kind of a genetic either-or because of the structure of it. The plant will either produce THC or CBD. I guess I'm at Stanford. I can say that they share the same allele, and it's one or the other will be expressed. And when you're breeding up for psychoactivity, you're breeding out the CBD and breeding up the THC. So it was assumed for many years that all the CBD in cannabis in California had been bred out. And this was the conventional wisdom that I heard when I covered conferences of cannabinoid research. There's a group called the International Cannabinoid Research Society that's drug company doctors and academic researchers, and they meet every year. And in 98, a British pharmaceutical entrepreneur, an MD named Jeffrey Guy, was at the conference and now describing his plans to develop a cannabis-based medicine, an extract of a plant that would be equal parts THC and CBD. And I interviewed him at that conference and said, well, can we in California do a similar thing? We have some great Burbank's up in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, unfortunately, we understand that it's not present in cannabis in the West anymore. And it wasn't until an analytic test lab came online about a year and a half ago that growers and dispensaries could bring samples to get them tested. And lo and behold, about 1 in 800 or 1 in 900 strains that get tested is got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% cannabidiol, and either an equal amount of THC or slightly less THC. And these strains are now being grown out. And if all goes well and the DEA doesn't seize too many of them, there will be CBD-rich cannabis coming into the pipeline this fall and winter. And soon there'll be enough out there for patients to begin filling out questionnaires. And the pro-cannabis doctors, there's a group called the Society of Cannabis Clinicians that has already drafted a survey to try to get collect data on the effects of CBD-rich cannabis, and we're about to start a kind of collective research project.
And there is, you mentioned in the paper, as of August, did they get the website up?
The Society of Cannabis Clinicians?
The project.
Project CBD, yes. The website is up.
It's a dot com.
It's projectcbd.com. Projectcbd.com. The website is just up and will be improved in the period ahead. But it's got the basics, and prime mover there is a writer named Martin Lee, a very good writer. He's the author of Acid Dreams, which is the social history of LSD, a highly respected book. And he's one of the very good writers who's come into the O'Shaughnessy circle.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick musical break. We're going to hear another track off your brand new CD. And let's speak about that a little bit. Sure. Your brand new CD is called Proposition 215, The Doctors Who Believed Their Patients and Other Songs by Fred Gardner. You've written all the songs on here, right?
I wrote them, and for better or worse, I'm singing them.
So you're a singer-songwriter.
No, I consider myself a lyricist, and if there's anybody out there who digs these songs and wants to add them to their repertoire, they're welcome to.
What are we going to hear right now?
The title track, if I punch the right button.
Number 5.
Proposition 215. Have you heard of our law called Prop 215? Passed by California voters just saying what we mean. Marijuana eases pain and grief. There's many a condition for which it brings relief. The state could not wait to cover up its ears. The long-robed judges said the wording just ain't clear. The cops and DAs held a council of war in secret to dis-implement the new law. Put heat on the doctors, that's the whole strategy, said Attorney General Lundgren. Then he flew off to D.C. to meet with Cardinal Constantine and Rabbi Alan Dershner, Reno and Shalala, like a scene out of Macbeth. It was back in December of 1996. General McCaffrey announced a big fix. California doctors, your license is at risk. Big Janet and the necklace nut off, tisk, tisk, tisk.
What were their names? What were their names?
The doctors who stood up for their patients.
What were their names? What were their names?
The doctors who believed their patients. I'm up in Crescent City down to San Diego. Many a physician had to just say no. Unless you've got cancer or AIDS, better yet, a letter of approval could prove difficult to get. Estrogens and statins, they're eager to prescribe. Prozacs and Viagras dispensed like a bribe. The detail men offer them trips to here and there. And the board never questions their standard of care. But those brave physicians whose plain common sense leads them to respect your anecdotal evidence get called Dr. Feelgood like it was a bad thing, and made to feel afraid every time a doorbell rings. They've helped a lot of people in this wide world of pain. The data they've collected shouldn't be in vain. Sabotage of research, when's it gonna stop? The practice of medicine is not a job for the cops.
What
stood up for their patience.
Fred Gardner from his brand new CD. And he's got the CD and the brand new copy of the journal O'Shaughnessy's. He's the editor-in-chief. We're talking about medical marijuana, folks. And there is a vote coming up, and we're going to get into that, too. But that talk about that song a little bit off your new CD, Fred.
Well, this is the ballad of Prop 215. The doctors, when Prop 215 passed in 1996, I guess it's important to review this history because, as you said, we do have another vote coming up.
Mm-hmm.
You got to realize who is against Prop 215.
Now, or remind people what 215 is.
It was 1996. It was the medical marijuana initiative that changed everything, that legalized marijuana for medical use. And the prime mover was a San Francisco club owner and activist named Dennis Perone. And Dennis lived in the Castro and had originally started the Buyers Club as his losing all his friends, his dearest friends, in the AIDS epidemic. Buyers Clubs had sprung up in the AIDS epidemic to get vitamins and various products that people hoped might be cures to pool resources and make bigger buys. Anyway, Dennis, who had been a dealer ever since he came back from Vietnam, let me tell the story of Dennis a little bit. Dennis Perone is a great. Nobody's really indispensable in a social movement whose time has come, but Dennis is a candidate for indispensable. He was a gay man who came out for the first time at the height of Vietnam during the Tet Offensive.
Oh my God.
He had seen so much carnage, he just thought if he was going to die, he might as well be himself. And he had one of his assignments was putting bodies in the body bags. He's seen a lot of death. And he also, on a leave, fell in love with marijuana and saw fields of marijuana growing in Thailand and fell in love with marijuana the way some people do. And he came back with 2 pounds in his Air Force duffel bag, came back to San Francisco, which he had fallen in love with on his way to Asia, and started dealing. And he would get busted. And he would get out of jail and he would start dealing again. And this happened 6 or 7 times over the next few years. And Dennis is one of those people, he just couldn't accept that a judge, a DA, a cop could tell him what he could put into his own body. And if he could use it, why shouldn't other people be able to use it? He was very, very tough, very tough fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis got shot. I met him. He had been shot in a raid, and he was in a lot of despair during the 80s. And then he kind of he started fighting back at the end of the 80s with the San Francisco Buyers Club. And he always wanted to be legitimate. And so he always had a political side. He was close friends with Harvey Milk, helped Harvey Milk get elected.
Mm.
What happened in 1994 and 1995, the California legislature had passed medical marijuana bills that were vetoed by the Republican governor, Pete Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of restrictive bills. They would have legalized it for use in cancer, AIDS, glaucoma, and seizure disorders, 4 or 5 specific conditions. And since it had been vetoed twice, Dennis decided to try to organize a popular initiative. And the initiative they weren't going to make it. They were running out of signatures. They weren't going to make it in terms of the signature drive. And they got help from the group. George Soros's group came in and helped pay for a professional signature drive that helped put it on the ballot. And at the time that it, and then there was this story takes a fork in the road because the Soros group tried to take control of the campaign and the leadership of the movement at that point, based on the fact that they could put up $1 million for the professional signature drive. What they didn't just say, here, we're going to help you indigenous leaders get on the ballot. They said, we're going to help you get on the ballot, and in exchange, we're going to take over. So you had two factions fighting, Dennis the Radical and Soros' agents, the liberalized diluters of the initiative. They weakened it immediately with ballot arguments that turned it into a merely an affirmative defense when you're busted, as opposed to a bar to prosecution that would have kept the cops from busting you in the first place and the DA from charging you in the first place. That's how, if you read the wording of the measure that became Proposition 215, you'll see that. But the ballot arguments that Soros' group imposed on it can be cited by judges as evidence that it's merely an affirmative defense. That's how they, that's part of what they did.
And it's so interesting too, because when Jerry Brown was governor the first time, he kind of decriminalized it in a certain way, didn't he?
I don't remember what he did specifically.
I think it was about a ticket. Just get a ticket. They couldn't take you to jail. They'd have to give you a ticket.
It was a misdemeanor. It was reduced.
They lowered the penalty.
And now, just recently, it's been reduced to an infraction that you can where you can just get
sign
a ticket.
Off.
Yeah. The getting back to Prop 215, there's another great figure in this story. His name is Todd McAree. He's the co-founder of O'Shaughnessy's. It was at his urging that I left the DA's office to do that, to do the paper. And Todd was the was Dennis's consultant at the Cannabis Club, and he had already interviewed 200 or 240 patients who were using cannabis through the San Francisco Buyers Club. And he was also a scholar and had studied the pre-prohibition medical literature. So he knew the range of conditions for which it had been used when in the past by doctors and written up for arthritis and menstrual cramps and insomnia and a wide range of conditions. So Todd's added in the drafting of Prop 215, Todd McAree, with Dennis's support, added the all-important first sentence, which made Prop 215 apply to listed some conditions, and then it said, or any other condition for which marijuana provides relief. In other words, whatever you've got,
it opened the door.
Well, it opened the door, and I think properly, because, you know, as Dennis would say, in a society where they're giving Prozac to shy teenagers, all marijuana use is medical. Why accept the double standard?
If they're gonna say
Clinical depression, you've got clinical depression, use Prozac, use Paxil, use Zoloft, use Wellbutrin. Then Dennis said, you've got clinical depression, you can use marijuana. It just applied their own standard. It's really semantics. But that opened things up in California. That was a very brave thing to do. And of course, if the Soros group, Ethan Nadelman and Bill Zimmerman and their group had power in the drafting of it, we would not have gotten this strong initiative applying to any condition for which marijuana provides relief. We would have gotten one of those weaker initiatives. And I can say that with confidence, because when they went on to other states, they pushed weaker initiatives, which, of course, are easier to pass.
So they weren't the guys with the white hats then. Soros didn't come in and try to save it. Now, jumping ahead, what are we voting for on November 2nd? It's not a medical, but we already have medical marijuana in the state, right? We're voting to legalize it for every citizen in the state?
Well,
or for adults?
Let's turn to the piece in O'Shaughnessy's by Dale Gehringer.
And if you want to get a copy of O'Shaughnessy's, folks, you can go on their website, and it's PC4MD. Am I correct there, Fred?
PCMD4U.org.
There you go. PCMD4U. What page are you on, Fred?
I'm on 49.
Okay, 64 pages in this thing. And folks, you might want to get a copy of this, because this is very critical information.
Prospects for Legalization in California by Dale Gehringer.
There you go.
The Regulate, Control, and Tax Cannabis Act, which is on the ballot as Prop 19, would authorize counties and cities to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana sales to adults on a local option basis, while completely legalizing the possession of 1 ounce or less by adults aged 21 statewide.
Now, what do you think of this, Fred?
Well, I think we're going to have to vote for it. There are Dennis Perone, who you know I admire, and Valerie Corral, who I admire, and other people object to some of the clauses that the organizers put in at the urging of consultants who thought it needed some punitive aspect to appeal to I don't know who. I'm not a great I don't believe in focus groups or the bill is flawed from there's something in it about not smoking in the presence of children, and what is it's ambiguous what that means, how far away, and this it doesn't apply to people between the ages of 18 and 21 are not protected, and I think it's a felony to if you pass a joint to somebody who's 17, I think that's punished under this act. So they put in these weakeners. But I'm going to vote for it because I think a lot of elections are the symbol, the message is what matters. And if this loses, the cops will have a green light to be even more aggressive. And if it passes, the whole world will see headlines that California voted to legalize marijuana. And that could only have a good effect.
It's true. It's true. Fred Gardner's our guest for the hour today. He's the editor-in-chief of O'Shaughnessy's, the Journal of Cannabis in Clinical Practice. And this ain't no dope-smoking hippie, folks. This is a guy who gets the facts. It's a journey. Fred, you're a journalist down to the bone, right?
Who you saying isn't a dope-smoking hippie?
I don't know. Who am I saying ain't a dope smoking hippie? A couple of more things we want to cover before this hour runs out, and it is going quick. We do have another track on your CD we want to play, but in this issue of O'Shaughnessy's, you had two great articles, one on a lady who had a kid with autism, who's got a child with autism, and she never entertained the thought of medical marijuana being part of the treatment. The kid was on a bunch of meds, and she had horror stories about this kid just freaking out like kids do with autism, and hard to reach, you know, couldn't communicate, and she had him in school, and he had terrible problems in school. And then this woman, who really wasn't an advocate for medical marijuana at all, tells a story that one of her caregivers, one of the medical folks that she was in touch with, asked her to consider medical marijuana. So she did, and they went through the procedures and got the paperwork and all that, and they did it. And in this article, she explains how clinically she saw major changes in this kid. Her child just changed from night to day. It didn't cure him of his autism. She's not trying to say that, but it definitely took the edge off, and it calmed him down. And she's basically testifying to this in the article. And I love the way the article is written, because you could tell that she's not trying to promote the use of medical marijuana. She's just saying what kind of effect it had on her kid. Mm-hmm. Speak to that article a little bit, Fred.
Well, the article is, the author of the article is Lester Grinspoon, MD, and he's a associate professor emeritus of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He was the first doctor to prescribe lithium carbonate for bipolar disorder.
Wow.
And he himself, so the woman's story of her autistic kid and the effective use of cannabis is told by Grinspoon, is quoted at length by Grinspoon within his article. And as he says, parents of some autistic children report that cannabis eases behavioral problems more effectively than these conventional pharmaceuticals, which, as you know, are hard on the liver and have many adverse side effects.
Yeah.
And Grinspoon says, when you have so much anecdotal evidence, when doctors keep hearing reports from their patients, this should be taken seriously and studied. And not there's a sometimes you'll hear people talk about mere anecdotal evidence. Grinspoon's approach is more respectful.
Another article you had in here was about, you triggered something when you mentioned that, and I don't know what triggered it, but there is a place in the current edition of O'Shaughnessy's that talks about the fact that it's been proven that smoking marijuana does not cause cancer.
Lung cancer, the
way we would think, the same way cigarettes do.
Yeah.
And that article...
That's a very important story, and it's a really underreported story. There's a preeminent, renowned pulmonologist at UCLA named Donald Tashkin. And Tashkin has been he's a veteran, and the National Institute on Drug Abuse used his work for many years in trying to promote the notion that cannabis caused lung cancer, and Tashkin's lab gave them ammunition in the 80s and 90s with photomicrographs of damaged bronchial tissue cells. You take a look at one of these slides and you'll never want to put anything in your lungs again. And he also identified the carcinogens in the smoke stream, benzpyrene being the most dangerous of them. And every time that Tashkin's lab would come up with a finding like that, it would be front page news, carcinogens in tobacco. And to this day, on prohibitionist websites and narcotics officers' websites, you'll see Tashkin, the finding that there are known carcinogens in cannabis. That's true in the smoke. So Tashkin wanted to put it all together with a major study showing that cannabis smoking caused lung cancer. And earlier in this decade, he got funding from NIDA and supervised the UCLA team that did what they call a gold standard study. They got 1,100 lung cancer patients through the county, and they matched them with a control group. They matched them for age and gender and neighborhood, socioeconomic status, every criterion that you'd want to match them for. And when they looked at the numbers, it turned out that the marijuana smoke, and they also, of course, recorded how heavily people smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And when they matched them, when they compared the two groups, it turns out that the cannabis smokers did not have higher incidence of lung cancer, and it looked like there was a slightly protective effect for people who smoked cannabis and cigarettes. It looked like they did not go on to lung cancer at the same rate as people who smoked only cigarettes, and given Tashkin's I interviewed one of Tashkin's colleagues on that study, and he actually used the word disappointment in connection with their finding.
Disappointed that it didn't cause lung cancer?
Well, they were disappointed. When you do an experiment, you have a hypothesis, and if the hypothesis isn't borne out by the evidence, you're disappointed.
Right.
His name was Safarian, another distinguished pulmonologist.
That's another great thing I really enjoyed about reading this paper. It's not just a pro marijuana paper. What you're doing is you're dispelling a lot of this disinformation that has been put out over the years. And there's been a major campaign of disinformation.
Yes, that's right. A major campaign of disinformation that we were all subject to growing up here in the land of the free.
Yeah. And what's so funny is we all got, and the reason I said dope smoking hippies earlier was that became the cliche term for anybody that advocated for marijuana in any kind of a way right up to today.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Absolutely. I feel there's lingering prejudice for sure.
Yeah, and now when it looks like there might even be true medical benefits to marijuana and some of its some of the stuff that's in it, we're still getting this fight back where, nah, wait a minute, you haven't proven that, or yeah, but it causes lung cancer, or yeah, but this and that. They keep bringing it up.
That's right.
O'Shaughnessy's is a major resource. And I and folks, if you're interested in medical marijuana or marijuana at all in any kind of capacity, you don't know anything about it, you want to know, get a copy of O'Shaughnessy's The Paper and their website, PCMD4U.org.
www. Can't leave that www out. I found to my
the triple dub. Now on and we're here with the editor in chief, Fred Gardner, on page 28. This is a report that I got to get you to talk about. On the top line, it's A Stall in the Name of Science, and the article is called The Institute of Medicine Report 1999. I know you got some heavy stuff to talk about this, Fred. Page 28.
The Institute of Medicine Report was commissioned by General Barry McCaffrey.
Our drug czar.
Well, here's the sequence of events. After Prop 215 passed, on December 30th, 1996, McCaffrey gets on television with Janet Reno, the Attorney General, Donna Shalala, the Secretary of Health Human Services, they call it now, and Alan Leshner, a salesman who was then head of NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse. And they denounced Prop 215. They denounced Todd McAree specifically. McCaffrey had behind him a big chalkboard full of the condition. They said Dr. McAree's Prop 215, Dr. McAree's list of conditions for to use marijuana for. And it listed about 20 conditions. And McCaffrey's was making the point that this in and of itself that proved the fraudulence of medical marijuana, because how could one drug be effective for so many conditions? And he called it Cheech and Chong medicine.
Well,
it turns out that the reason cannabis is effective for such a wide range of conditions is it's acting on a neurotransmission system, the endocannabinoid system, and it's basically it's achieving homeostasis. It's toning down pulses that are too loud, too fast, and even speeding up some that are too laggardly. It's achieving some kind of balanced effect in various receptor systems.
More of an herbal kind of a remedy than a chemical.
Well, I guess you could put it that way. But it's a balancing effect that the endocannabinoid system is just a neurotransmission system that exists. It's a good analogy is think of a conductor of an orchestra, and to some to the French horns he's saying make it a little louder, and to the bassoon to the violins he's saying tone it down now, and the cannabinoid system is like the conductor of all the other neurotransmission systems that you've heard of, GABA, serotonin, and dopamine. The rates at which they're being released and firing are modulated by the cannabinoid system. It's the master modulator. And that's why it affects so many systems and has such a broad effect on the body. Anyway, so McAree was onto something, and
Barry McCaffrey
calling it Cheech and Chong medicine was an idiot. And something happened in the next month. He changed his line. And he started saying more. Barry McCaffrey, the drug czar, suddenly started saying more research is needed. And then he found the money to put the institute to assign the Institute of Medicine to do a study and determine whether there was medical potential in cannabis. And later in January 97, Harold Varmus, the head of the National Institute of Health, did a similar thing, and he said, we shouldn't decide these issues by plebiscite. We need to see what the experts say, and they convened a panel of experts, medical experts, and the government medical experts decreed that more research was needed. Now, more research is needed is a truism. More research is always needed.
Kind of a stall.
Exactly, a stall in the name of science. And if you're a basketball fan, it's a four-cornered stall.
There you go.
Involving NIDA, the DEA, the Drug Czar's Office, and the FDA.
Kind of a conspiracy. We're talking to Fred Gardner, the editor-in-chief of O'Shaughnessy's, and O'Shaughnessy's is the Journal of Cannabis in Clinical Practice. And you can go on their website at PCMD for the number 4U, PCMD4U.org. And don't forget the triple W in front and find out where you can pick a copy of this up. It's the summer edition. When does the next edition come out, Fred?
Well,
is it quarterly?
It comes out when we have enough money to pay the printer and have something new to say. But we will have a lot new to say this time because
after the vote.
Because of the, well, no, that's not our realm, really. We're going to be following the CBD story.
Which is, oh, yes.
The cannabidiol story.
Yeah, we'll, definitely.
By the time the next issue comes out, we'll have some data to report, some input from patients. Because questionnaire, the dispensaries that are going to distribute CBD-rich cannabis will also be distributing questionnaires so that the doctors can start making sense of what people are saying.
This is a heavy stuff. You got a lot of stuff. Now, let's touch on the Louis Armstrong article. How did you...
Saving the best for last.
Huh, yeah, buddy? this is amazing. This Louis Armstrong used to tape himself. Mm-hmm. So I guess he was telling a story, some stories from his life or his life story that I maybe he was thinking would turn into a biography. Did it turn into a biography? An autobiography?
Yes, a man named Terry. There have been a couple of biographies, and a man named Terry Teachout published one last year, from which we quote in this, after running a piece by Louis Armstrong himself, because...
in his own words.
He did speak into... he decided to kind of tape his memoirs back at his home in St. Albans, Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And a cannabis scholar named Michael Krawitz calls Louis Armstrong the first activist because he was very brave and outspoken about the use of cannabis.
Yeah, he admitted, he was one of the first entertainers to admit that he used it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And in this article you got, he tells a story of getting busted. He was playing an extended engagement in Los Angeles, some big place that he didn't mention and exactly what it was, and said he got popped by a couple of detectives out in the parking lot. He was smoking a joint with the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said the detectives flipped on him and said, you know, we love your music. We hear you on the radio every night. And we were sent over here from the band leader down the street because you're taking away too much of his business. And he dropped a nickel on you. Now it was called a nickel. Now it's called drop a dime on you. And they told him that.
If you can find a payphone.
Exactly. And speak about this article, though, Fred. It's just amazing in Lewis's own words.
Well, the first article.
I guess there's two of them, huh?
There's two. There's the article by Louis Armstrong. It's hard to tell from this confusing layout, but the article is called "Tight Gauge." This is in quotes. "Tight Gauge," GAGE. That was one of many slang words, and it was Armstrong's favorite term of choice for his drug of choice. "Tight gauge, more a medicine than a dope," close quote. That's from Louis Armstrong. He realized that it was more medical than anything else, and he would say so. He was, as I say, very, very, very brave, very outspoken. And let's see. I guess I should just read it.
Well, we got a couple of minutes.
Okay.
We're running a little short on time.
But anyway, people don't know, Louis Armstrong did 9 days in jail in L.A. in the 30s. And
he said all the cops at the station, when they took him down, all told him, hey, man, we love you. We've been hearing you on the radio.
Yeah.
And they gave him 9 days anyway. He said they let him out, and he went right back to the club and played as if nothing had ever happened. They gave him time served because he could have got 6 months.
He had some powerful club owners on his side who maybe another black man in the same situation wouldn't have fared so well.
Well, a lot of black men got a lot of time back then for minor offenses and
still do
stuff like that. Fred, we are running short on time, and I want to go out with another song from your CD. The website for O'Shaughnessy's folks is PCMD, the number 4U, PCMD4U.org. Fred, anything else you want to impart to the folks before we take it out with one more song?
Well, I thought in the Stanford-Oregon game on Saturday that the Stanford guy was down and before he fumbled, and that should have been called back, and that play that changed the momentum of the game.
Those are probably Oregon refs.
Something. It was as crooked as the prohibition of cannabis.
There you go. Fred, thanks. Thanks once again, and let's do this again real soon, okay? Get a copy of O'Shaughnessy's, folks. You've been hearing Fred Gardner on Shedding Light.
Iceman, Magic Bird, McAdoo, Big Old Joe, Kevin, and Sweet Lou. In the real world, just like in the schoolyard game, take who takes you. Some days, no way they're gonna fall. You've got to play D and move the ball. In the real world, just like in the schoolyard game, don't call every little call. You may be with the white folks up in Eugene, or with the Bloods on 135th. You'll fit right into any new scene if you know who to run with. It's you take who takes you. Such a simple principle and oh so true. In the real world, just like in the schoolyard game, take who takes you. Any pickup game I ever been to, any playground scene of any kind, you'll find they're easy to get into if you only just bear in mind that you take who takes you. An Eastern philosophy universally true. In the real world, just like in the schoolyard game, take who takes you. In the real world, just like in the schoolyard, take who takes you.
Fred Gardner and O'Shaughnessy's and his new CD, Proposition 215. Check it all out on the website, pcmd4u.org. This is KZSU Stanford.